Good morning. Welcome to the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Portland. This is Norm Diamond, your host this morning. Patricia Kohlberg is our producer. The Old Mole is sponsoring a photo exhibit, 30 Years in the Streets of Portland, the Activist Photography of Betty Lee. Each week we post a new photo by activist photographer extraordinaire Betty Lee, documenting Portland's history of street protest and resistance. Along with the photos, on the Old Mole's Facebook page and on our webpage at KBOO, you'll find Betty's accompanying reflections. This week's wonderful photo brings back great memories, 13 people suspending themselves from the St. John's Bridge for over 40 hours, preventing a Shell oil ship from proceeding to the Arctic to enable drilling. Along those lines, here's Patricia Kohlberg with a victorious update on the struggle to block Zenith Energy's expansion in Portland now, maybe even to block its continued existence in Portland.
Good morning. I just want to give a quick shout out to the huge number of local organizations, environmental activists, and elected officials who came together to convince the Portland City Council to deny Zenith a key permit, which could finally spell doom for that fossil fuel corporation. The council was not expected to take this bold action. That they did should be very heartening to climate justice movements everywhere, because it demonstrates the power of community organizing, the only thing, frankly, that's going to save us from climate chaos. Without an informed and enraged and committed community behind them, I doubt the council would have had the courage to take this stand. The other point worth making is that the decision was not based on narrow technical terms, the terrain on which these battles are so often fought. Instead, the council denied the permit because the Zenith crude oil operation is inconsistent with the community's clearly articulated values and desires, including its commitment to climate justice and a sustainable future. As was written in their denial, quote, "The extent of the fossil fuel activity and potential adverse impact on the environment and historically marginalized groups is not compatible with the comprehensive plan policies," end quote, which plan was adopted to address the challenges of transitioning to clean, renewable energy. This was a decision about standing up for what is right, rather than hewing to narrow bureaucratic rules, or worse, caving in to the legal and financial firepower of big corporate entities. The Old Mole sends its thanks to everyone who helped make this happen.
Thank you, Patricia. KBOO is able to be on the air because of listener contributions. When you go to our webpage to look at Betty Lee's photos, please notice the button that says Donate and act accordingly. On this morning's program, Bill Resnick interviews Simon Torresinta on the pressures behind unending consumerism and the consequences for climate change. What alternatives do we have, and what would a better life look like? Larry Bolden reviews a novel about the tension between reason and spirituality, a novel he finds remarkable for its emotional intelligence. Luisa Martinez returns for more on her Venezuela trip, this time talking with Austin Gonzalez about the development of communal structures they investigated there and the role of communes in the socialist project. They talk briefly also about Peru and its recent presidential election. To wrap up the program, I'll return with an episode of Another World is Possible, this one called From Utopia to Dystopia. Leading off, here's Bill Resnick with Simon Torresinta.
Simon Torresinta, welcome to KBOO in Portland, Oregon.
Thanks. I'm glad to be here.
Today, Simon Torrescent and I will be discussing consumption, consumerism, how in capitalist societies, especially this one, we are urged and seduced in media, popular culture by many industries and pressure from our social groups to gain happiness and fulfillment in consumption. And do we consume? That is the people that can afford it. And many others actually go deeply into debt. If this continues, we could wind up on an uninhabitable planet. Our human experiment ended by global warming. Simon and I talk about that also. And finally, we discuss how we can reconstruct this country, stop global warming, and do a lot of other wonderful things, work less, get involved in human relations and activities that produce enduring happiness and fulfillment. I learned of Simon Torrescent. He's finishing a PhD at Yale. I wanted to talk to him after reading his review of a book by Kate Soper titled A Low-Carb and Good Life for an Alternative Hedonism. That title, the hedonism, does not mean abandonment of everything but the search for pure pleasure, but rather it means the happiness and fulfillment of a good life. His review for me demonstrated a depth of knowledge and a generous thoughtfulness on issues of capitalism and consumerism and climate change and the complexity of popular consciousness. So, Simon, tell us about the various critiques of consumption and the consumer society. There's a lot of them.
So there are much more longstanding critiques of consumerism that go back at least since the beginning of mass consumer society itself, so from the 40s and the 50s. And, you know, the sort of most obvious critique that lives on is that became most prominent in the 60s that we associate with intellectuals like Herbert Marcuse, was this idea that capitalist society was creating these false needs, that through advertising and through other modes of indirect social control, that people were being forced to consume or sort of seducing to consumption, and that was distracting them from the sort of exploitation that they were experiencing. But what I was interested about with Kate Soper's book that I was reviewing is she puts a new twist on those older critiques. I think, you know, one thing that's particularly interesting about our contemporary period is that it's becoming increasingly clear that consumption, whatever we make of that older critique, is also unsustainable for very different green, ecological, or biophysical reasons, right? So these days, much of the attention of decarbonization is devoted to things like greening the grid, to alternative modes of electricity generation, like wind and solar, to electric cars. But decarbonization, so the, you know, reduction of our carbon emissions at the scale that we need, is going to require a much more fundamental social transformation than that. And the problem is that many patterns of consumption in rich countries, especially the United States, think of flying, meat consumption, et cetera, are very highly carbon intensive in themselves, or they require such amounts of energy that even if we did switch to green power generation, they'd require very damaging amounts of land and resource use, and they would lead to more deforestation or extraction. So just to take one example of that, you know, the news has been a buzz lately with a push for electric cars, but, you know, electric car batteries require rare earth minerals like lithium, and we can't really swap out every private vehicle in the world with an electric one. That would require huge amounts of lithium that we aren't sure we have, and that would also lead to huge amounts of extraction mining, especially in the global south. So that really brings a new perspective to older critiques of consumption, which is whether or not it's good for us, it's bad for the planet. And very fundamental changes in our patterns of consumption will have to follow if we want to fully decarbonize our economy.
In Kate Soper's book, you went into another critique, which is very important. That is a popular critique. There are so many ways that people, even as they're consuming, deal with it sardonically. There's a self-critique of consumerism that people use. Let's say the shop till you drop. Well, most people use that sardonically. They don't really want to shop. They know it isn't what they really want to be doing. And yet it's sort of diverting and distracting, and they do it with friends. So they refer to, we're going out to shop while you drop. Or there's clothing rebels, you know, and people who dress up in costumes the way we used to in the 60s. I was from a middle-class family, and I used to wear blue work shirts. Well, of course, the fashion industry co-opts all of that. And there are action critiques you talked about, like interest in crafts. a lot of action critiques, growing disillusion with automobiles, more biking. Tell us about that.
I think what is particularly interesting about Zofa's work and, you know, what I found productive was that she identifies all these movements in society as it is that seem to suggest a kind of popular discontent with the idea of the good life that we're told, you know, on Super Bowl TV ads or through advertising or any other standard message is what we ought to want. And so she looks at things like the turn to craft, attempts to reuse and recycle, the slow food movement, the sort of clamor for increasing access to green space, the new urbanism, right, that focuses on walking and biking at the expense of cars. And she sees in that not necessarily an explicit political commitment, but a kind of more implicit, more low-level dissatisfaction, right, a register of dissatisfaction with the good life of high consumption. And she sees in that the seeds of a more radical transformation and one that we would need to make and may even want to make if we want to live in a decarbonized and perhaps even more pleasurable society than the one we have now.
You know, I remember reading, I can't find the citation, a study of janitors who are on the cleanup crew of big buildings with marble floors. And the janitors, I mean, they had to do the work and make enough to feed their family. But they did the work in ways where the water spreading machines and then the drying machines, they would leave streaks. And the janitors sort of competed making art with their machines. So the streaks at some point for a minute before it dries out, the streaks were some sort of transient art. And I think that's an effort to take what people would consider the worst kind of work and make it into both a game and a art project. There's more going on in even people at the lower rungs. And yeah, comment.
Yeah, absolutely. I think this speaks to this broader question of hedonism, right, that is raised by this question of consumption and in Zofa's book, which is that people have a need for forms of pleasure, but those forms of pleasure don't necessarily have to come through conventional forms of consumption of fixed goods, right? So things like cars or clothes or whatever, that there can be forms of pleasure that come from much deeper needs for meaning, for kinship, for being with others, for being outside, and for also for forms of art and forms of craft. And I think the anecdote about the janitors is a sort of emphatic example of that, right? That even in work that many of us would think of as potentially judgerous, clearly there's a need for a form of art making, right, and a form of self-expression. And as we think about this broader question of pleasure as it relates to climate change, we can think about the forms of mass public luxury and consumption that aren't carbon intensive, but that nevertheless make our lives meaningful and happy. And I think Zofa is very compelling on this idea that a greener world doesn't necessarily have to be a pleasureless or austere world.
This is Bill Resnick for the Old Mole Variety Hour on Cable Radio, 90.7 FM, Portland, Oregon. I'm talking to Simon Taracinta. He's doing a PhD in history. He wrote a really interesting book review on consumerism and the possibilities of a radical alternative to finding pleasure and fulfillment. We discussed the critiques of consumerism, where one, the capitalist drive for growth and increased consumption has generated climate change. We've also discussed the growing popular critique of increasing numbers of people trying to find pleasure in creative activities and crafts and reading and writing groups, even in alternative religious groups that are far more democratic. But if people are trying to exit the system, if they're at least beginning to see are in fact succeeding in exiting the system to some extent, and if they are beginning to see the need to stop growth and consumption and reduce climate change to manageable levels, ultimately restore the ecosystem upon which life depends, but they also fear the radical changes that are necessary. So however attractive, however much they carve out spheres of life outside of the market and market consumption, today the great majority, in my sense, would be hesitant to take seriously our alternative. After all, they need to keep working, earning income, changing most everything, including all of industry and how they operate and what they make, and some industries disappearing. That creates anxiety, and people become even more precarious than they are now, which requires us to think about what can be done now to prepare the way for the great mobilization to make all of the necessary changes. First, Simon Taracinta, right now people are not ready to make the radical changes that are necessary. They do have a stake in the system. Tell us more about that and why now they aren't ready to join the revolution. And then we can conclude with what we can do now that would change their minds, that would contribute at least to changing their minds as the situation grows more dire and decisions have to be made.
I think a lot of people right now, whether they like it or not, are in some sense trapped or forced into patterns of intensive consumption of one kind or another, partly because of the built environment and the infrastructure that we have, the sprawling suburbs, right, of detached houses that are heated on their own, et cetera, and lack of access to transportation, that sort of thing. But on the other hand, also by the arrangements of our society where most people have to work all the time or nearly all the time in order to survive. So I think both of those things, the infrastructure and the nature of making a living, would have to change in order for people to be able to make the kinds of transition that we're talking about. So that would require, I think, very different modes of social policy. People's needs would have to be met in at least partially in other ways. And for me, that's why things like a fight for single-payer healthcare or the decommodification of housing or free education, even if on the face of it they don't seem like they're really about climate change, they're actually, for me, very fundamental to that question, because people will only be prepared to make a radical transformation in their life if their basic needs are met, if they feel secure enough to do that, and also if the built environment and infrastructure around them facilitates that. You can't choose to start taking the bus to work, for instance, if there is no bus line servicing your neighborhood, right? And so these things would have to change in order for people to be able to make any change at all. And so some of the ideas that Soper talks about in the book are especially around the question of the drastic reduction of working hours. So at the moment, there's a kind of work and then spend treadmill, right? Part of the reason that we consume so much is that we work so much and we don't have the time to use our leisure in freer ways, right? We only have a few hours off here and there. And then that gets concentrated in carbon-intensive forms of consumption. But we can imagine a very different society in which we worked far less and we had much more time to devote to things like care work, right? Or caring for ourselves or for relatives, to devote to education, to the arts, to nature. And all these things, you know, aren't very resource intensive at all, but they often provide more enduring and fundamental forms of satisfaction. But in order for people to want that, that would already need to be a reality somewhere. And so for me, I think the vision is building real places, be they cities or elsewhere, that start to construct this kind of alternative society that in some sense would be a proof of concept. Of course, the problem with climate change is that emissions anywhere cause a problem for everywhere. So eventually there would have to be a more broad global transition. But I think the starting point can be local. And I think constructing something in one place can be a model for everywhere else.
You've already brought us to the final issue today, how to advance our alternative, what is to be done to save the planet and let people lead the lives that they yearn for with all the consumer goods they need and more time for really fulfilling activities. Seems to me we have to distribute our wealth also a whole lot better. Every job should be a living wage job and secure. Precariousness also is one of the reasons people are so afraid to defy the boss. Before this interview, I asked you about my hypothesis, whether you might want to reply to it. I think you accepted. Anyway, let me state a hypothesis about what has to be done. You've already, in fact, pointed some of the things out. That is, climate disasters are going to become more frequent and damaging and dangerous. People are certainly going to recognize that threat and demand action. So if starting today we begin to demonstrate the superiority of our alternative, partly by talking about our alternative and its feasibility, and partly by creating those model cities and model programs that you discuss. Some now, though, the cities are actually operating on the way to 100% renewable energy, but mostly operating on the technological side. But it's not beyond the realm of possibilities that people would ultimately choose us over the emerging capitalist alternative, which relies on new unproven technologies like safe nukes, carbon capture, sequestration, hydrogen energy. None of them, there's been a lot of research in all of them, and none of them are solutions. And they're being proposed by those elites who have been actually delegitimated by their years of inaction and profit-seeking uber-alles and their climate change denial. Simon, I gather you find that that way of looking at it, that when people get roused out of their fear of upsetting the apple cart and losing work, that there's a far greater threat to them and their children, that they'll be, if we do our work now in legitimating that transformation that we need, we could in fact prevail. At least there's a chance.
Yes, I think that sounds very plausible to me, and I think it's a cause for hope. What I would say and what I would stress is that I think that the rising fear that is undoubtedly going to come as climate disaster gets worse, as wildfires get stronger, as extreme weather continues, that we urgently need to figure out a way to channel the feelings that are going to come out of that into productive political expression. At the moment, so much of the mantra that we hear when it comes to climate change is doing our part in this highly individualistic way. Recycle more, shop less, drive less, etc. And those are all good messages, but individualizing the problem is also a way of removing responsibility from broader social structures and from bad actors, be they corporate or government. And I think channeling that energy and that dissatisfaction that we spoke about earlier into avenues of remaking society now will make it more likely that we will have those viable models in the future when things get increasingly dire and we have something to point to. So what I would say as well is I think we need to convince or show people who are already fighting for their livelihoods, teachers striking for a living wage, people fighting for public housing in cities or for access to green space, that their fight is actually part of a broader fight that's connected to climate change and the question of decarbonization, and that the more we can win as these kinds of public goods, the more we unlock these forms of public leisure and public consumption that give us an alternative vision of the good life that can replace the damaging one that we have at the moment. So I think it's partly about showing a viable alternative and partly about connecting a lot of existing energy and existing political mobilization that's already happening.
Yeah, one final thing. Not only are we told to turn off our lights at night and all of these sort of individual drive less, drive an electric car, even a Tesla, which requires so much in the construction of it and the mining for it and all the rest that it cancels out any good it would do. We hear that. We also hear from our comrades a great emphasis, it seems to me, now and for the last several years on defeating and stopping the fossil fuel industry. And I think that's a good idea. I mean, that's absolutely necessary, and they've done really good work. But I think they have to pivot a lot more towards building and promoting our alternative, that we have one that it's feasible and that we can live much better. You get the last word, Simon Torricento.
I agree, and I actually think there are two sides of the same coin. I think we can build power by building forms of alternatives, by creating an alternative good life. And that actually gives us the political capacity to fight back against fossil fuel. And I think, if we can walk and chew gum, we'll be in a good place.
Simon Torricento, very good talking to you. If you want to read more, I recommend his most excellent review of the Kate Soper book in the New Labor Forum. And he's also published in the Boston Review and the journal N+1. Simon, thanks a lot.
Thanks so much, Bill. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you, Bill and Simon Torricento. Bookmole Larry Bolden has an unexpected find, a novel he calls insightful and remarkable for its emotional intelligence.
Good morning. This is Patricia Kohlberg, and I'm reading once again for Bookmole Larry Bolden. I want to talk to you today about a lovely book, a 2021 novel by Jeff Arch, titled Attachments. This is primarily a love story, a love triangle between two best friends and one girl loved by both. But it is an incredibly complex story full of lies and secrets. Stuart Goodman, known by all as Goody, and Santimo Piccolo, known as Pick, are unlikely best friends. Goody is a quiet and reflective boy who ponders all the big questions, while Pick is brash, cynical, and dismissive of all things spiritual. Laura is Pick's girlfriend and the love of his life. The three become fast friends at the boarding school all three attend. Years after the three leave the school, a teacher, Griffin, becomes the dean of the school, and as the story begins, Griffin is felled by a stroke. And his last conscious words uttered to his secretary, who sees him fall, are, "Pick and Goody." Throughout the book, Griffin is suspended between life and death on life support machines. There are other characters who sometimes act as narrator, but I'm not going to try to sum up the story. The author jumps from time to time and from character to character in a dizzying manner that makes the entire novel read as a kind of stream of consciousness. I'm more interested in conveying a theme returned to again and again in the novel, which I will call a struggle, a tension, between clear, cold reason and spirituality. I see it as the author's argument with himself about this tension. Much like Ian McEwan's wonderful little novel, Black Dogs, in which it is clear that McEwan favors the life of reason his philosopher brother defends, but feels the pull of that which reason seems not able to explain. The Black Dogs represent the two sides. We might even say the left and right hemispheres of the brain. Plato uses a similar metaphor in his description of the tripartite soul, the black steed of passion or appetite, the white steed of spirit, and reason as the charioteer. Pick has a no-nonsense view of all things, while Goody seems open to all religions. At one point, Pick takes Goody to task for talking admiringly of Jesus, although Goody is a Jew. Quote, "They want you to behave a certain way," Pick went on, "so they throw Jesus at you. Look at history, for Christ's sake." Goody shook his head. "It wasn't propaganda when it started, though." "You think he was the Son of God?" Pick asked. "I didn't think you guys were allowed to." Goody crumbled up some more hash and dropped it into the pipe bowl. "To me, Jesus is... he's like the older brother, you know, like the ultimate older brother. I mean, God is the Father, right? Everybody at least agrees with that." "Everybody who believes in God." Goody looked at him to see if he could actually mean that. "Well, when you're a kid, you know, your father, he's this powerful thing. He's this force," Goody went on, "and he's above you, and he's mysterious, and everything comes from him. And then Jesus, he's like your older brother. He explains your father to you. He's off to the side, just a little, and from there he interprets things, so that you can understand what the hell is going on sometimes." Pick looked at him. "That's what the Jews think?" "I don't know what they think. Nobody ever talks about him." End quote. While I am clearly on the side of reason and defend atheism, I have a sense for what both McEwan and Arch are wrestling with. This is a truly beautiful love story. The love between Goody and Pick is lovely, and both characters are drawn fully and carefully. The love Laura has for each of the boys, in turn, is beautiful, rather than trashy or deceitful. The love of Griffin for his wife and son, all of these loves are described so well. Because of the many narrators and the sudden, unannounced shifts of time and place, this is not an easy novel to follow. Added to that is the obvious fact that Arch is most comfortable as a screenwriter, so almost all of the text is in the form of monologue or dialogue. This is just a beautiful book, and as touching an examination of the many kinds of love as I can recall. This is not a book I would have picked up as a matter of course, but it fell into my hands from one of the readers in a small group of friends who pass along books to each other, and I was deeply touched by it. In many ways, Griffin, who never speaks for himself, is the glue that holds the book and the characters together. Does he survive the stroke and return to his school and his family? That is something readers will have to determine for themselves. I have been talking about Jeff Arch's novel, Attachments. And this is Patricia Kohlberg reading for Book Mole, Larry Bolden, and for the Old Mole Variety Hour.
Last month, Luisa Martinez shared with us her excitement on discovering in Venezuela that even with the hardships imposed by U.S. sanctions, the project of building socialism still moves forward. Following just a bit of Venezuelan music by Rawayana, Luisa talks with Austin Gonzalez, specifically about Venezuelan communes.
Oh, yes, yes.
Este flow hace que muevas el esqueleto. Mosca, no te me distraigas, que hasta tu jevita baila. Más perro que un Rottweiler, así me pongo yo cuando entro en calor. Cierra tus ojos and make a wish. Si no anda, enciéndete un spliff y pégate en el trip. Como en el arte lo hacía Dalí.
Hey Olmos, this is Luisa Martinez, and today I'll be speaking with Austin Gonzalez of the Democratic Socialists of America. Austin Gonzalez is a Virginia-based organizer of Puerto Rican descent, and he is currently on the National Political Committee of DSA. He helped found the Richmond, Virginia's DSA chapter and assisted in the foundation of other chapters around the state. Austin was part of two important delegations on behalf of DSA. One to Peru as an election observer, and the second with me to Venezuela as delegates to El Congreso Bicentenario de los Pueblos del Mundo, or the Bicentennial Congress of the People of the World, a couple weeks ago. And I gave a report back on my trip, which we can link on the website. I was able to go to Venezuela, but not Peru. And so today we speak with Austin, who can give his perspective on what he was able to learn down south. Austin, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me here, Luisa. I'm very excited to have this conversation.
Wonderful. Okay, so let's touch on Venezuela first. So I think the particular interest and something that I said I was going to talk about last time were the communes of Venezuela. So can you kind of give a brief summary of the movement for communes in Venezuela?
I could easily talk about the communes for a good 5 hours straight. So I think the communes, when I think of the communes, I think of them as such a very special project, not for Venezuela, but for socialists across the world, right? It was in Hugo Chavez's final speech, right? His famous strike at the helm, golpe de timón speech, where he quite famously uttered the catchphrase now, which is all across Venezuela, comuna o nada, right? Commune or nothing. What was he talking about, right? What are these communes? Commune or nothing? What does that mean? Well, as I'm sure a lot of people listening know, right? Venezuela is this country that has been, I would say, attempting to transition to socialism for a couple decades now, right? For the first whole decade of the quote-unquote Bolivarian Revolution, for the first whole decade of, you know, the advent of socialism or whatever we want to call it in Venezuela, right? A lot of what manifested itself kind of came from the top level down. A lot of what manifested itself was Hugo Chavez and PSUVE, or at the time, the Fifth Republic movement, kind of combating with the former right-wing forces that still had their claws deep within Venezuelan society, right? Combating with a lot of the different right-wing businesses, right? There was the famous oil lockout in the early 2000s, right, against Chavez. There was the coup against Chavez in 2002. So that first decade, a lot of the struggles in Venezuela, a lot of that was just combating the right. It wasn't until Chavez's final speech during the beginning of the previous decade, right, the 20-teens, that Chavez asked, where is the commune? We've been building toward this for over 10 years now. Where is the building block of socialism on the ground level? Where is the community coming together to build socialism, right? And this moment was very important because Chavez also had all of his cabinet ministers lined up feeling very awkwardly, right? Kind of like basically shaming them like, hey, is there bureaucratic issues here? Where is the commune? And the reason I mention this and the reason I give this background here, and I'll try to be brief, is because it's critical context for why the Commune Project is what it is in Venezuela today and why it's so important, right? After that speech and after Chavez's death and now the presidency of Nicolas Maduro, we've really begun to see a flowering and blossoming of the Commune Project in Venezuela. I'd say probably the most notable example that I love to give people right off the bat to give them a kind of an idea of what the communes in Venezuela are like, and I know where I imagine we'll talk about this a little bit in a little bit more detail here, is El Maizal, right? El Maizal commune, which is in, I believe, Portuguesa state, right? Which is kind of in like central western Venezuela, right? And El Maizal is a giant corn commune. They make corn there. Corn is, you know, like many Latin American countries, corn is a critical component of the Venezuelan diet, right? So El Maizal is this massive corn commune where all the people who work there, they work in every decision they make, they vote on, right? All the proceeds they get from selling the corn, they hold in commune and in common, right? They have a community bank. And this is why I say when I look at the communes, when I look at things like El Maizal, these are the true building blocks of socialism, right? This is the beginning, or at least I'm a proponent of the Bolivarian Revolution, if you haven't figured that out by now. This is what I say is, once again, the true beginning of the manifestation of socialism, the manifestation of workers truly owning the means of their production. And Luisa, when we went down there to Venezuela, right, you remember, I was jumping for joy when I found out that we would be meeting communes, because I'm just a guy over here in Virginia, right, to actually be able to see this firsthand was such an enlightening experience. And once again, we literally could talk for hours about just each commune visit in and of themselves. Because once again, being able to see people, these people struggle, especially in the face of blockade, in the face of sanction, seeing these people struggle to build these communes, build these communities that once again hold all the things they hold, they make in common, was truly an amazing experience. And we visited a bunch of different communes. I think one of my biggest takeaways when I think about going down there and seeing these communes firsthand is how much they do. I was always under the impression, because I was, once again, just a nerd, right, who reads books and stuff. I was always under the impression that these communes specialize in certain things, just like I mentioned El Maizal. To go there and see places like Comuna Luisa Cáceres, right, and seeing how they basically did everything. Comuna Gran Mariscal de Ayacucho, I think is what that one was called. How they do everything, right? Making clothes for themselves, making food for themselves. They even had their own security guard. You remember that guy? They literally did everything. So once again, I'll leave it there on that question, because once again, I could literally go forever just talking about a bird's eye view of the communes themselves.
Yeah, one of the more interesting things that I picked up is we got to speak to a couple communards. Of them, most famous is Angel Prado. He's kind of referred to as the president of the communards. He recently won his party's primary to run as the mayor of Simón Planas. And one of the things that was mentioned in that conversation was really this effort to re-envision what we consider work, right? So the first commune that we visited, this was in Caracas, in a middle-class part of Caracas. And I think the idea was that you devoted 4 hours a week to literally help building the commune, right? We visited what was a half finished structure that was going to be housing for people. And so really having people understand that there's a new way to envision one's labor and how one's labor can be produced. But let me ask, what was your takeaway from our conversation with Angel and the other communards?
Angel Prado is such an interesting guy for so many reasons, right? Angel Prado, one of the reasons I feel like he's kind of, you mentioned, he's like kind of like the president of the communards, right? I feel like he's almost attained like folk hero status for like a lot of, you know, comuneros in Venezuela for a lot of good reason, right? And one of the reasons I find him so fascinating is because often he comes in conflict with the state. Often he comes in conflict with PSUVE. And I love one of my biggest takeaways from conversing with Angel Prado, right, is kind of, you mentioned them trying to re-envision work and whatnot, right? I also see through Angel Prado and El Maizal's conflicts with the state, I see the beginnings of the communes battling the bureaucracy. And part of the reason they're in that battle is because they're assuming the roles of the state in many ways. In Venezuela, we saw a state that was very much weakened because of sanction, right? It's very difficult for them to provide for their people. So for these communes to be able to provide as much as they do, truly, like, and I know this sounds so dramatic for any of my Marxists out there, right? I feel like I truly see the beginning of the withering away of the state, so to speak. And that's why, to me, Angel Prado is such an important and interesting figure, because he's one of those people that, as you mentioned, Luisa, he was at the Congreso. He's not out here boycotting the government, even though he does come in conflict with them, right? He recognizes the dialectical relationship that the communes have with the government, this dance that the communes do with the government, where, you know, maybe your local bureaucrat is not the best person in the world, but you don't say, I'm throwing the baby out with the bathwater, and okay, actually, Pasuve is this evil dictatorship. No, they grapple with the actual contradictions that exist within their society. And it, once again, it forces them to ask very difficult questions of what is the relationship between a truly autonomous workers' commune and the state itself? But once again, I could go on for extremely long about that as well.
Well, it really highlights the different positions that people play within the Venezuelan Socialist Project. So obviously people who are, who are communards and who are drawn to those types of projects, they are to the far left of what we consider kind of one's political consciousness. And naturally that would sometimes come into conflict with something like a mass party, PSUV, or the Grand Patriotic Pole, which is a coalition government. And so they maintain power by, I don't think they have any choice, by sometimes making concessions, right? Just as a way of maintaining maintaining control and maintaining the support of elected people. And so that's something that I really walked away with from our trip, the importance of understanding the dynamics of that struggle, and how we could all learn from it as socialists. But let's switch gears for a second. You also visited Peru to observe the elections there. So first off, let me ask, you kind of hit some, there was some pushback when you got there. Could you explain that?
First of all, yes, I did also visit Peru. I had quite an interesting summer, I must say, going to both Peru and Venezuela and seeing the things that I see. So I'm assuming this is what you are referring to. And if not, please enlighten me, because there are many different ways that I could take this question as far as pushback that we received both before and after we landed. Funnily enough, it was clear to me that we arrived in, and anybody who follows like politics in Latin America, this is no surprise, but it was very clear to me that we arrived in a very polarizing atmosphere, right? I spent all my time in Lima, I should be very clear, and this was a deeply fractured place. The first thing I saw, literally as soon as I landed, was a giant billboard, or I should say the first political ad I saw when I landed was a giant billboard. And you want to know what that giant billboard said? It said, Cinco días para votar no al comunismo, right? 5 days to vote no to communism. So that's the kind of campaign that the right wing and Keiko Fujimori were running. And if you, and when we would talk to average people about this, you know, we would ask people in Lima, which was kind of like a right wing Keiko Fujimori stronghold. We would ask them like, oh, well, who are you voting for? For anybody who said they were not voting for Castillo, they would say, oh, Terruco Senderista, you know, things like that. He's a terrorist. He's with the Shining Path, things like that. And it was clear that the campaign that Keiko Fujimori was running was a very negative one. And that was extraordinarily clear to us, as opposed to, you know, Castillo supporters who would talk to us about the new constitution, right? They'd also talk to us about ending the corruption of Fujimorismo, right? So once again, I arrived in Peru to a very polarizing atmosphere.
So can you give us just briefly a background on Professor Pedro Castillo, who ended up winning the election?
So Pedro Castillo is such a fascinating dude, right? To me, the bottom line is he is an organic representation of the Peruvian people in every sense of the word. And what the hell do I even mean by this? There were massive protests in Peru late last year that led to the resignation and, I think, not the impeachment, but basically like the forced stepping down of a president for pressure, right? So things were all falling apart. Pedro Castillo, as a leader of teachers' unions in Peru, right, had been a part of different protest movements in Peru, hence his nickname El Profe, right, as a leader of teachers' unions. Pedro Castillo was able to tap into this anger, was able to tap into this resentment that a lot of Peruvians had toward the system and channel it into his campaign. It was a shock to me and to the international community to even see Pedro Castillo make it to the second round. So Pedro Castillo, an amazing figure. He carries a giant pencil around with him wherever he goes during his campaigns. So that's also extremely awesome.
And you managed to get a giant pencil as a token. Congratulations. So could you briefly kind of summarize why is Pedro Castillo's election important for, say, leftists in the United States?
We just got to think about Peru. Peru is the former seat of the Inca Empire, right? Peru is an immensely resource-rich country, right? Second largest copper reserves in the world. They have some of the largest gold reserves in the world, some of the largest guano in the world, right? It's amazing how resource-rich Peru is. Hence, Pedro Castillo's famous catchphrase, right? No más pobres en un país rico, no more poor people in a rich country, right? And this is one of the biggest reasons why this is critically important to leftists, not only in South America, but also leftists in North America and the United States. This is Peru, a critically important part of South America and a critically important country within South America. Also, a historically right-wing country in South America. This is a country that has been very right-wing for like the last... basically its entire existence. Like, this was a country that it was even right-wing during the Wars of Independence, right? When Bolivar and San Martin were coming through. So like, this is a country that was the seat of the Spanish monarchy, right? There is deep entrenched reaction within Peru. So to see Peru, this right-wing country where the Lima group was literally capitaled, the right-wing alliance, that is, to see Peru go left-wing is a earth-shattering development for South American politics, to put it lightly.
And it certainly has implications for us in the United States to see a country that has such an entrenched history of right-wing leadership move to the left. I think it's very inspiring. So let's finish there. Austin, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you so much, Luisa.
Thank you, Luisa and Austin Gonzalez. Now it's time for Another World is Possible. In our very first episode of Another World is Possible, long ago, we looked at an amusing short story by Louisa May Alcott about an effort to establish a utopian community in the mid-19th century United States. It was a way to talk about the relationship between idealism and practicality, vision and skepticism that underlies so much of our response to utopia. The story, Transcendental Wild Oats, also brought out the gendered nature of much utopian imagining. Some of the fun of the story came from the contrast between the highfalutin speechifying of the men and the day-to-day decisions and actions that had to be made by the women. But it's not obvious to most people in most times that there are alternatives, that another world is possible. In the next episode, we look deeper into that time period, exploring the social and economic developments that enabled people then to recognize that a fundamentally different organization of society was indeed possible. Politically, we contrasted mere outrage, which of course presupposes that something better could happen, with the recognition that change at the roots could make things vastly better. One topical example we cited was the difference between advocating for better training or more restraints on the police in our own times, on the one hand, or the actions that would follow from realizing that policing itself would be basically different in a society founded on racial and economic equity, available social services, meaningful work for all, and fully democratic control. We are surrounded by a culture that encourages a sense of determinism and inevitability, that the social and economic arrangements that exist are the only ones that could exist, that all history has led to where we are now and could have led nowhere else. Our work, our TV watching, internet browsing, sports spectatorship, are structured in ways that make it increasingly difficult to imagine significant alternatives. Really, to make a difference, we have to change that sense of possibility. Part of the answer of what enabled utopian dreaming in Louisa May Alcott's time was the social disruption caused by the expansion of market relations. One aspect of this was the creation of America's first industrial proletariat, not immigrant male workers, but young women from farm families, meeting new family needs for hard cash in what had been more of a subsistence economy. But what became of these young women, initially housed decently with chaperones, schooling, and cultural events, quickly turned utopian dreaming into dystopian reality. Writing very shortly after the experience about which Louisa May Alcott wrote, Herman Melville, author of Moby Dick, already was warning his readers both about the tyranny of machines and about the health and spiritual consequences for these young women. His story, The Tartarus of Maids, describes a visit to a paper mill. Tartarus, in Greek mythology, refers to the deepest depths of hell. Maids, in the language of Melville's time, were unmarried women. So, The Tartarus of Maids. Patricia Kohlberg will read some passages. Here's the story's protagonist, his first impression.
Not a syllable was breathed. Nothing was heard but the low, steady, overruling hum of the iron animals. The human voice was banished from the spot. Machinery, that vaunted slave of humanity, here stood menially served by human beings, who served mutely and cringingly as the slave serves the sultan. The girls did not so much seem accessory wheels to the general machinery as mere cogs to the wheels.
The first-person narrator requests a tour.
He took me up a wet and rickety stair to a great light room furnished with no visible thing but rude, manger-like receptacles running all round its sides, and up to these mangers, like so many mares haltered to the rack, stood rows of girls. The air swam with the fine, poisonous particles which from all sides darted subtly as motes in sunbeams into the lungs. "This is the rag room," coughed the boy. "You find it rather stifling here?" coughed I in answer. "But the girls don't cough." "Oh, they are used to it."
The flying machinery into which the workers insert their hands remind him of weapons.
"The edges of those swords, they are turned outward from the girls, if I see right, but their rags and fingers fly so, I cannot distinctly see." "Turned outward?" "Yes," I murmured to myself, "I see it now. Turned outward, and each erected sword is so borne edge outward before each girl. If my reading fails me not, just so of old, condemned state prisoners went from the hall of judgment to their doom. An officer before bearing a sword, its edge turned outward in significance of their fatal sentence. So, through consumptive pallors of this blank, raggy life, go these white girls to death. Those sighs look very sharp," again turning toward the boy. "Yes, they have to keep them so. Look." That moment, two of the girls, dropping their rags, plied each a whetstone up and down the sword blade. My unaccustomed blood curdled at the sharp shriek of the tormented steel. Their own executioners, themselves wetting the very swords that slay them, meditated I.
And finally, about the threat posed by this new kind of industrial enterprise and about its workers.
Something of awe now stole over me as I gazed upon this inflexible iron animal. Always, more or less, machinery of this ponderous, elaborate sort strikes, in some moods, strange dread into the human heart, as some living, panting behemoth might. But what made the thing I saw so specially terrible to me was the metallic necessity, the unbudging fatality which governed it, though here and there I could not follow the thin gauzy veil of pulp in the course of its more mysterious or entirely invisible advance, yet it was indubitable that, at those points where it eluded me, it still marched on in unvarying docility to the autocratic cunning of the machine. A fascination fastened on me. I stood spellbound and wandering in my soul. Before my eyes, there, passing in slow procession along the wheeling cylinders, I seemed to see, glued to the pallid incipience of the pulp, the yet more pallid faces of all the pallid girls I had eyed that heavy day. Slowly, mournfully, beseechingly, yet unresistingly, they gleamed along, their agony dimly outlined on the imperfect paper, like the print of the tormented face on the handkerchief of Saint Veronica.
There's a complex relationship between utopia and dystopia, those supposedly opposite, but really closely linked ways of understanding the world and its possibilities. Melville was writing a warning, not settling for what he saw happening around him. His stance was that things don't need to develop the way they are going, that another direction was possible. We'll continue to explore the relationship between utopian and dystopian visions here on Another World is Possible. This has been Norm Diamond for the Old Mole Variety Hour. That's our program for this Monday morning. I'd like to thank Old Moles Bill Resnick, Patricia Kohlberg, Luisa Martinez, Larry Bolden, and John Nelson for their contributions, and our guests Simon Torrecinta and Austin Gonzalez. As always, a special thanks to the staff here at KABU for keeping the station going in these far too long, difficult circumstances. I'm going to leave you with some more Venezuelan music. Again, this is by Rawayana. Till next Monday, please stay safe and stay active.
Vente pa'l sur. Vente pa'l sur. Vente pa'l sur. Vente pa'l sur. Vente pa'l sur, donde tú vas a divertirte hasta el final. Welcome to el sur, donde tú sabrás el costo de tu libertad. Vente pa'l sur, donde tú vas a divertirte hasta el final. Welcome to el sur, donde tú aprenderás a mover esas nalgas. Guacamaya.